You know, I have a problem with religion, which is a bad thing if you're a religious leader, I suppose. But sadly, I am as guilty as anyone when it comes to this problem. Oh, thank you. And my problem is that religion just generally often resembles the Padres, San Diego Padres. As you saw in the pictures, we went to the Padre game last night with a group from the church. A lot of fun. To my amazement, the Padres won. Never happens when I go to the Padre game, so that was unusual. But the last night was jersey night. All fans in attendance got a Padre jersey. Al's wearing his today. So that's cool. When we arrived, Lori and I, when we arrived, we walked through the turnstiles, and they handed me this little package. And there was a little blue cloth inside, and I said, "What's this?" And the gal says, "It's a bandana." And I said, "I don't got to wear no stinking bandana." No, I didn't say that. I said, "Why are you giving me a bandana? I thought this was jersey night." And they said, "Well, we ran out. So I got a bandana, Padres bandana." Lori and I got to sit there, thousands of people in the stadium wearing their Padres jerseys, and we had our bandanas. Felt a little awkward, you know. Oh, I can. Okay. Actually, I don't really care that much. But it was a little bit disappointing, you know. They promised something, and when you get there, they didn't deliver. And that's the problem I have with religion a lot of the time. It promises something and doesn't deliver. You know, when you think about what, for instance, our religion, Christian religion, what it promises, sounds really good. You know, this is a religion where you're going to have people that are a new creation. They're transformed. They're a new kind of human being who are, they're people who are not of this world. Their hearts beat for something other than what this world is about. And God is real to them. And they don't stress over stuff, the stuff that most people stress over. They know God, and they know God will always provide for them. So they live at peace, and they forgive when they're disappointed or when they're hurt by others. They love unconditionally. They love sacrificially. They're humble. They're honest. They can always be trusted. Man, that sounds really good, doesn't it? Yes, right. Here's the problem. Is that what most of us deliver? You know, I've had the misfortune to deal with Christians in the past when there was a dispute over money between them. I've discovered that when someone stands to lose some serious money, or from their perspective get shortchanged or cheated, you find out what they're made of. And you find out, it seems an awful lot of the time Christians are made of the same stuff as the rest of the world around us. Christian parents, their hopes for their kids are that their kid will be a star in the sport they play in, and they'll be the best student in the class, and they'll go to the best college and go on and get a great job and make a lot of money and be wealthy and maybe famous. And how is that any different than the world around us? We talk about peace and trusting God, but when we suffer setbacks or face serious financial struggles, you'd think that God had died, or maybe worse, turned against us. I've been dismayed at even pastors who preach sermons about forgiveness and unconditional love when treated in a way they deem unfair or hurtful, become resentful and bitter. Promise is one thing. What it delivers is not quite the same, and that's where the problem is. A pastor, a lawyer, and a doctor in the upper Midwest went out deer hunting, and as they were hunting, they came across this magnificent buck. And all of them saw it at the same time, and simultaneously they fired their rifles, and the animal went down. And now the argument began. Whose shot actually killed the animal, and who does the buck belong to? And they're arguing, and the argument gets more and more ferocious, and all of a sudden the game warden comes along and interrupts them, stops it because he realized they're about to come to blows. And he says, "What's the problem here?" And they said, "Well, we all saw this buck, and we all shot, and we all think it was our shot that the bullock, you know, got the buck, belongs to us." And so he says, "Okay, let me see if I can help here." So he goes over and he examines the the animal. And after looking over for a few minutes, he stands up and he says, it was the pastor's shot that killed him. And they said, well, how do you know that? And he said, well, obvious. It went in one ear and right out the other, you know? Yeah. Yeah, that's how it feels a lot of the time. And the saddest part about that is it's when your own sermons go in your own ear and right out the other. And you see the same thing in yourself. Like, I ought to be one thing, but I deliver something else. Where does this come from? Luke chapter 20, verses 9 through 19 is one of the parables of Jesus. And I think this parable tells us, gives us an idea of where this comes from. In fact, it pictures it and then explains where it comes from. I think you'll see that as we go on here. Here's what happens. Speaking of Jesus, says he went on to tell the people this parable. A man planted a vineyard, rented it to some farmers, and went away for a long time. At harvest time, he sent a servant to the tenants so they would give him some of the fruit of the vineyard. But the tenants beat him and sent him away empty-handed. He sent another servant, but that one also they beat and treated shamefully and sent him away empty-handed. He sent still a third, and they wounded him and threw him out. Then the owner of the vineyard said, well, what shall I do? I know, I'll send my son, whom I love. Perhaps they will respect him. But when the tenants saw him, they talked the matter over. This is the heir, they said. Let's kill him, and the inheritance will be ours. So they threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. What then will the owner of the vineyard do to them? He will come and kill those tenants and give the vineyard to others. When the people heard this, they said, God forbid. Jesus looked directly at them and asked, then what is the meaning of that which is written? The stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces. Anyone on whom it falls will be crushed. The teachers of the law and the chief priests looked for a way to arrest him immediately because they knew he had spoken this parable against them. But they were afraid of the people. All right, first thing we need to understand in this little story is that Jesus actually addressed the issue of authority here. Little background, in Luke chapter 19, just before this, in verse 45, we read of Jesus that he entered into the temple area there in Jerusalem and began driving out those who were selling. Now, that's a familiar story to many Christians. What was happening was that there were people selling animals that for the purpose of sacrifice. People would come to Jerusalem. If you're going to worship God, you had to make sacrifices, and you had to do that in Jerusalem. And so people, Jewish people from all over the Roman Empire, would go to Jerusalem to make sacrifices. Rather than having to bring animals along with them, what they would do is they would come to Jerusalem and buy animals there. And so this business sprang up there in the temple area of people selling sacrificial animals. Furthermore, you had people coming from all over bringing their currency from their home areas in Macedonia and Pamphylia and all these places, and nobody knew, you know, well, what is your money worth? Well, so you had people there that were currency exchangers who would, for a fee, exchange currency into the local currency so they could give that money in the temple. Now, nobody saw anything wrong with that. It was a convenience for worshipers. But there was a problem, and that was that this had become a very big business and become established part of the whole worship system to the point where the business was becoming more important than the worship for a lot of people. And Jesus understood that. There were people who were making money off of worship. You can understand that Jesus was not too fond of this. So he threw those people out. He said, no more of this. You know, it kind of reminds me of the story. This is a true story. Actually, I read some years ago of this. There was a church in the South that they decided they wanted to try to increase their attendance. And the way they could do that was they began having chicken dinners after church, after the worship service. And they became very popular. In fact, they became so popular that lots more people were coming to the chicken dinner than were coming to the church. And eventually, they just quit having the worship services. They just had the chicken dinners, and it became a restaurant. That's kind of what was going on in Jerusalem, and Jesus said, enough of this. And he threw those people out. He said, he quoted Isaiah 56:7, "My house will be a house of prayer." You people are all about money. That's what's happening here, and that's not what this is about. And so we're going to stop this. Well, you can imagine how well that went over. Frankly, the religious establishment was kind of tied into the business. I think that they were making some money off the deal. So when Jesus did this, it upset a lot of people. So the religious leaders come to Jesus and they said, in verse 2 of this chapter, "Tell us by what authority you were doing these things. Who gave you this authority?" In other words, who gave you the right? They're really saying, who made you God? Well, that's an interesting question, but, you know, Jesus is going to answer that one. Who gave you the right to do what you've just done? It's very upsetting. One of the remarkable things about Jesus, one of the things I love about him, when you study Jesus, that you'll see this, is his amazing aplomb when people come to him with questions, particularly sort of hostile questions like this one. He frequently doesn't answer the question. He just asks another question or tells a story. And in this case, he does both. He asks a question, then tells a story that actually ultimately answers their question. You can see his question in verses 3 and 4 of Luke 20. He says, "I will ask you a question." You want to ask me a question? "Tell me, John's baptism, was it from heaven or from men?" Now that seems a little weird, but what he's essentially saying is, oh, you want to talk about authority. Okay, let's talk about authority. Where did John get the authority to go around baptizing people? Where did that come from? And as soon as he asked that question, his questioners, the religious leaders, knew they had a problem. John was going around baptizing people. Now, what you need to understand is that everybody understood there was the Jewish people, God's chosen people, and then there were Gentiles who were just the rest. Actually, the word Gentile is a Latin word that meant the nations or the tribes, just all of them. There's all of them, and then there's Jewish people, God's chosen people. If a Gentile wanted to actually worship the one true God, he had to go through a process, and the last step of that process was some ritual washings that would be, in essence, a symbol of him washing away what used to be and being clean now to be able to worship the true God. John the Baptist comes along, and he's baptizing people, which is a way of saying to them, you have exactly the same problem that the Gentiles have, and you need to be cleaned as badly as they do. That was an offensive message to the religious leaders, who said, no, we're God's chosen people. This is wrong. And so they didn't like John at all. The problem was that the Jewish people loved John because what he said struck a chord with them. They went, there is something wrong here. We've got this religion that it doesn't touch people's hearts. And that's what John's talking about. You need to be changed from the inside out. He's right. So they loved John. Now, for the religious leaders, they had this problem. And the problem was, if we say what we really believe, which is John has no authority to do that whatsoever, he's wrong, the people will hate us. You know, they wanted to be religious leaders. One of the things about being a leader is you really kind of need to have followers if you're going to be a leader. You know, I mean, it doesn't do much good for me to say, yes, I'm a pastor if the only person in my church is my wife. You know, who would consider me a pastor? The IRS wouldn't, unless I had the right political beliefs. Or maybe I should say the left political beliefs. But anyway, that's another issue. Yeah, a little commentary there. So the religious leaders are going, well, we've got a problem. We can't say what we really think. So what do? Well, they do what politicians always do when they're faced with a problem, a question they don't want to answer. They dance around it. They say, we don't know. We don't know where his authority came from. That's a lie. They knew exactly what they thought. They just weren't going to say it. So Jesus says, all right, fair's fair. You want to answer my question? I want to answer your question. And then he immediately launches into this story. But oddly, the story answers the question. He sets his audience up. They think he's not going to answer the question. Then he tells a story, and the story speaks directly to the question of authority. Where do you get your authority, and where does Jesus get his authority? You'll see it in this passage. So what's the story? Well, there was a landlord who had some really awful tenants. You know, in this story, this man owns some prime land, that land up there in Napa Valley, perfect for vineyards. He decides, since he lives in San Diego, he's going to, rather than try to run the vineyards remotely, he'll just lease the land out. So he says, okay, you guys, I'm renting you the land. You lease the land, you grow the vineyards, and then you pay me the rent. Part of the crop is the rent. Time comes for him to collect. He sends an employee up to collect the rent, and what happens? They say, we're not going to pay you. In fact, they beat him up, sent him away. Well, the landlord says, well, that's no good. And so he sends another guy, maybe a guy that's a little more intimidating, you know, more experienced, something. Second guy goes up there, gets worse. They beat him up even worse. He sends a third guy up. Same thing. This guy they send away wounded. Now, at that point, you got to ask, what would any normal human being do? Of course, in our society today, you take those people to court. I mean, can you imagine if you had a rental property and you have somebody in there and they're just thumbing their nose at you? I'm not paying the rent. You send representatives, they beat them up. Man, you're going to send the cops. We're going to evict you. We'll take you to court. Back in that day, it wasn't quite so easy, but you would assume at this point that the wealthy man, what he would do is hire a goon squad, you know. We're going to go down there and we're going to knock some heads. But he doesn't do that. He says, I'll send my beloved son. Surely they'll respect him. And of course, we see what happens in the story. He gets there and they say, he's the son. He's the guy that's going to inherit the land. You know what? If we kill him, the land will be ours. Now, there are some scholars, biblical scholars, who will read this and say, oh, well, there were, you know, maybe there was an idea back then where squatters, if they had the land long enough and there was no obvious owner or heir, they would take over rightful ownership of the land. That's not what's happening here. What's going on is Jesus is painting a picture of some people who are irrational. What they're thinking makes no sense whatsoever. It is idiotic, and he's intentionally doing that. Oh, you think that you're going to kill this guy's son and you think that's going to work in your behalf? That's stupid. Yeah, that's exactly the point. We need to remember what happens down here at the end of this story. Verse 19, the teachers of the law and the chief priests looked for a way to arrest Jesus because they knew he had spoken this against them. They're the tenants and they know it. The sad part here is that this is Israel's history in a nutshell. In Luke 11, verse 49, Jesus said, God in his wisdom said, I will send them, speaking of Israel, prophets and apostles, some of whom they will kill and others they will persecute. In Luke 13, 34, Jesus said, Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those sent to you. Micaiah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Elijah, Micah, Amos, Zechariah, Ben Jehoiada, all of them were at best mistreated, some of them killed by Israel, prophets sent from God to Israel, and they were not received. In fact, they were rejected and in many instances killed. And Jesus says that is exactly what you people have done. You who build the tombs for the prophets say, oh, God sends us prophets. You're the people who keep rejecting them. And now, God has sent his son. And what are you going to do? You're going to kill him. So In the story, we see that the landlord then dealt with the deadbeats. At this point, what's he going to do? Well, everybody knows. He's going to come and he's going to knock heads. He's going to reap judgment on all of them. And that's the point of this story. Yeah, you reject him. God is eventually going to come and there's going to be a judgment when you kill his own son. The people, interestingly, say, God forbid, may this never be. They're listening and they're saying, you're saying that the people of Israel are going to reject the Messiah and that God is going to come and judge them? May that never happen. And then Jesus quotes Psalm 118, verse 22, and he said, you don't think that's going to happen? Then what in the world do you think this psalm meant? The stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone, the key stone you rejected. Man is lost out in the vast desert. Days go by, he runs out of food. Then he drinks his last drop of water. Soon he's staggering through the blazing heat, parched, nearing the end. He's got to have something to drink or he's going to die. And when he feels like he's on his last legs, all of a sudden he thinks he's hallucinating. He sees a man walking towards him in the desert. And then he realizes it's real, and he thinks, I'm saved. And he runs up to the man and says, sir, please, can you give me some water? And the man says, oh, I'm really sorry. I don't have any water with me. But I do have a beautiful selection of neckties. Would you like to buy a tie? The man says, a tie? I'm dying out here in the desert. Why would I want a tie? He thinks it's all over. I'm just going to die. Discouraged, he staggers on. He says, there's one more big dune. I'll just climb to the top of that. And if I don't see an oasis or something, I'm just going to die up there. He staggers up to the top. And he gets and he looks over and he's stunned. Down at the bottom, there's a restaurant. He can't believe it. He staggers down to the restaurant. He goes to the door, and the maitre d' stops and says, I'm sorry, sir. Gentlemen aren't allowed in without a tie. Yeah, okay, sorry. The very thing you needed most is what you rejected, and that's exactly what Jesus says the people of Israel are going to do, and the result is they're going to be judged. God will come, and he will judge. And those who reject the stone will be broken to pieces. Wow, okay, that's kind of a grim story. What is this about? And how does it relate to us? Well, okay, there's some things we need to understand here. And the first is that we should never mistake patience for inability. That's what Jesus depicts in this story. The first thing we need to notice is, who's the owner of the vineyard? Well, that represents God, right? Do you notice the remarkable patience that he pictures the owner of the vineyard having here in this story? I mean, after the first person, his first representative, is mistreated, shouldn't the owner come and do something about it then? But he sends another, and then he sends still another, and then he sends his own son. That is remarkable patience. And that's saying, that's what we need to understand God is like. Nahum 1:3 says, the Lord is slow to anger and great in power. Nehemiah 9:17 says, you are a forgiving God, gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and abounding in love. God is patient in the extreme, patient to a degree that we can hardly even fathom. But we need to notice that Nahum 1:3 says he is slow to anger. Not that he doesn't say he never has anger. He's slow to anger. He's patient. But he is great in power. In other words, he's very, very patient with you, but there will be a time when there will be a judgment. And God is able to deal with the situation because he's great in power. My freshman year in college, I had an experience that kind of ever since then has reminded me of this truth a little bit about the nature of God. I was playing baseball. This is a baseball story from a long time ago. I was a freshman, and I was batting against a guy that I'd never seen him pitch before, so I didn't know what he had. The first pitch he threw me was just a weak fastball, and I just crushed it, but I hit it foul. Okay, well, I'm going to, you know, that's all this guy's got. He's in trouble. I'm going to destroy this guy. Next pitch, another weak fastball, but it was way outside, you know, and then he throws me another one that was inside, and all three of the first pitches, they were all fastballs, and they were all just batting practice. They were just, I thought, this guy's terrible. I'm going to kill him. Then he throws me another one, and I thought, oh, another one, and this one's going to be right over the heart of the plate. And I cranked up, and I swung, and just as I was starting my swing, I thought, there's something funny about that pitch, but I'm going to hit this thing. And I started my swing, and just before I got the ball got to the plate, it looked like it rolled off a table. It just went, whoop, and went straight down. It was like physically impossible is what it looked like. And I stood there thinking, what just happened? I mean, I swung and missed badly. And then the next pitch, he did the exact same thing, and I struck out. And I went walking back to the dugout going, what was that? He was throwing a knuckleball, and I had never seen a knuckleball before as a batter. And I was completely mystified. His first three pitches, he lulled me to sleep. He was being patient. It wasn't because he was unable. Because he was setting me up. Now, God is not setting us up. But the fact that he's patient, that he has waited a long time to bring judgment, to deal with situations, is not because he's unable. It's because he's patient. But he will deal with the situations. We think about, why has Jesus taken so long in coming back? It's because God is patient. In fact, in 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 9, Peter wrote, the Lord is not slow in keeping his promise, as some understand slowness. He is patient with you, not wanting anyone to perish, but everyone to come to repentance. So God is patient, and this is important for us. It can help us when life takes an unpleasant turn and we don't understand, why is this happening? You know what? God is patient. He doesn't operate on our timetable, and we need to be patient and trust him. It also is really critically important when we see things happening in this world, or when someone does us wrong and we want to lash out and we want to get revenge, we need to remember what Romans 12:19 says. Do not take revenge, my friends, but leave room for God's wrath. For it is written, it is mine to avenge. I will repay. God will deal with it, so we don't have to. Those are in God's hands. We don't need to worry about them. So God is patient, and we need to understand that. But now there's a second thing I think that we should take from this, and this is really the heart of what I want us to see, and I think that Jesus was aiming at, and that is that we need to let God be Lord in our lives. The question that arises when you read this story is, how was it that the people of God could end up being compared to deadbeat tenants who refused to acknowledge the landlord's ownership? In fact, they ended up having a religion that ended up being outright opposition to that, to their own God. How did that happen? There's a tendency, like I said earlier, among religious people to tailor their religion so that it fits the life they want to live. I want to be able to kind of live my life over here and do things the way I want to do them without, you know, and have some God in there, but not have him kind of impinge on the way I want to be. I want to just sort of do things my way. And that's what was going on back then, and it's always gone on. This was true of the religious leaders as well as the people they were supposedly leading. All of them were failing to acknowledge God's authority in their own lives. One of the major problems that Israel as a people had was a tendency to fall into idolatry. You go all the way back, think about Exodus 32. people of Israel have been in slavery in Egypt. Moses comes along, set my people free, you know, let my people go. The plagues, they cross the Red Sea, you know, the parting of the sea. They get out in the wilderness, and God says, okay, Moses, I want you to come up on Mount Sinai. I'm going to give you my law, and this is going to be the agreement that you're going to live by. Okay. He goes up on Mount Sinai, and he's there 6 weeks. Well, the people say, well, we've had enough of this. You know, we want a God that's a little more, you know, immediate. You know, where'd he go? Who knows? He's probably back there in Egypt someplace. And we want a God that's going to get us out of this wilderness and get us what we want. We're out here in this wilderness. It's dry. It's desolate. There's not much food. There's no water. We're going to die out here. So we need a God that's going to be with us and lead us out of here. So, hey, Aaron, how about getting us another God? So, sure enough, Exodus 32, 1, they say to Aaron, come, make us gods who will go before us. This God, yeah, he's failed us. We need a God who's going to get us where we need to go. Can you make us a God that will get us out of here? And so he did. You remember the story. Verse 4, Aaron made an idol in the shape of a calf and says, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. Let's follow these gods. That's great, Aaron. Nice work. Right there, you have the essence of the problem of idolatry. They identified something that they wanted, and that was more important to them than worshiping God. We want to get out of this wilderness, and we want to go to a place where there's milk and honey, food, drink. So give us a God who will get us there, and we'll worship that God, because that's what we care about. This was not an anomaly in Israel's history. 2 Kings 17, verses 7 and 8, we read about the destruction of Israel by Assyria, and here's what the author says. All this took place, all the destruction, because the Israelites had sinned against their Lord God, who brought them up out of Egypt from under the power of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. They worshiped other gods and followed the nations, the practices of the nations the Lord had driven out before them. Psalm 78, verses 57 and 58 says of Israel, they put God to the test and rebelled against the Most High. They did not keep his statutes like their fathers. They were disloyal and faithless, as unreliable as a faulty bow. You know, that would be really bad. If you're, you know, imagine you're an ancient soldier and you've got your bow and arrow and you're in battle and, oh man, here comes the enemy and he's coming right to you. And then the arrow just... because the bow doesn't work. That you can't have that. God says, that's Israel. Man, half a chance. They're off worshiping some other idol. Why? Well, because they're looking around. What they really want is they want power. They want security. They want a lot of stuff. They want to be wealthy. And they're looking around. They're saying, hey, those guys are worshiping that God, and they're doing well. Let's worship that one too, just to make sure. Cover all of our bases, sort of hedge our bets, you know? Because we want to, this is what we care about. That's the problem. They identified what they care about, and it was power, it was possessions, it was security, it was all of that kind of stuff. And that's what they really worshiped. In his book, Israel's Greatest Sin, Bernard Taylor wrote that the ancient contemporaries of Israel believed that each people had their own gods. So, you know, all of the ancient peoples, they believed in lots of gods. And their gods only had power where they were worshipped, in the territory where they were worshipped. Well, Israel was supposed to come with this new message. There is one God who rules over everything, and we're going to be his priest, tell you all about him. Taylor said that when the Israelis accepted the God of some other nation, they would not simply fail to impress this important truth on the nations around them, but would most effectually teach that it is not so. And in tracing, he says, the history of the Israelites, it is very evident that their downfall was due to their idolatry more than anything else. They kept saying, we want these other things and we will pursue them, and that is more important to us than letting God be God. Now you might say, well, now wait a minute. Jesus' contemporaries, they weren't worshiping idols, and they weren't worshiping the Roman God, so how does that apply to them? And how does it apply to us? We don't worship other gods. Here's how it applies to them. Jesus' contemporaries, especially the religious leaders, had a system that they had set up, a religious system that allowed them to have position, respect, power, and to be wealthy. And that's what they wanted. They had a desire for Israel itself to become powerful and to defeat the Romans, and so they as a nation could be powerful. And these were the things they really wanted. And when God sent his son into the world and he said, your system is wrong, they rejected him. And they didn't do it because God didn't give evidence. You look at the life of Jesus, he gave the evidence they needed to believe that he was Messiah. By their own reasoning, they should have acknowledged that. But they rejected him. And why did they reject him? Because he was a threat to what they really wanted. They had something else that they were worshiping other than the true God. Go back to Exodus 32. What should have happened when Israel was stuck out there in the wilderness at Mount Sinai, waiting for Moses? Here's what should have happened. The people of Israel should have said, we will worship the true God and him alone. No matter what happens, we will worship this God. And if this God calls us to come out here and he leaves us alone out by this desolate mountain and he lets us die here, then so be it. That's what we'll do. Because we will worship him and serve him and him alone. And if that's what he wants, then that's what we'll do. That actually happened in Israel's history at one point. You may know the story, you probably do. Daniel 3, many of the ancient Israelis were living in exile in Babylon. Some of them were such impressive people, they were actually had become a part of the Babylonian government. Among them were three young men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And you remember the story? Nebuchadnezzar makes a huge idol of himself and says, everybody's got to bow down and worship this idol. And those three guys refused to do it. Nebuchadnezzar was furious. He said, you guys, I brought you into my own government, and now you're being disloyal to me. You bow down or you die. I'm going to throw you into a blast furnace, and you're going to be burned up, horribly painful death, if you don't bow down. And they said, sorry, dude, can't help you. We don't bow down to any human being. We worship God alone. And Nebuchadnezzar says, you want to be thrown into the furnace? And in Daniel 3, 17 and 18, they said this, if we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to save us from it. Oh, that's great faith. Wow, can you imagine that? You want to throw us in the furnace? Well, you know what? Our God can save us from that. But, huge, but, even if he does not rescue us, we want you to know, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold that you have set up. That is exactly the issue, isn't it? You know what? If God says, it is my will for you to be thrown into a furnace and die because you won't worship an idol, then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said, then so be it. So we die. We will serve God no matter what. That didn't happen too often in Israel's history. Unfortunately, it doesn't happen a lot in our lives either. And that's where the problem with religion begins. Religion starts with saying, true religion starts with saying, this is my God and he is Lord and he rules over every single thing in my life. And he will have his way in everything in my life, no matter what it may be. A couple of years ago, Steve Martin, Owen Wilson, and Jack Black starred in a movie called The Big Year. Kind of a funny premise. It's all about these three guys. I think we got a picture of them. There they are. Who are bird watchers. And they have this big competition to see who can spot the most species of bird in 1 year. And that's the big year. Owen Wilson plays Kenny Bostick, who is arrogant, he's cutthroat, and he holds the world's record for 732 species in a year. And they're having this big competition, and it gets weird as they compete and go to all corners of the world to try to spot a new variety of bird. And with Bostick, it becomes so bad that it's his marriage to his wife Jessica is falling apart. Finally, after he's missed another important doctor's appointment with her again, she says, "You know what? I love you, but I can't take this anymore. I don't want to be married to you anymore." And he tries to convince her not to leave him. He says, "Come on, give me a break. Just this year. Just this year. And then it's over." And she says, "It's every year. I know you, and I know that right now, even as we talk, you're in pain trying to think how you're going to get on your flight to Phoenix to see more birds without looking like a jerk." And he says, no, I'm really in pain because I love you, and I'm scrambling to make this work. And she says, "Well, enough to not go to Arizona?" And he says, well, no, I have to go to Arizona. And she says, "Why?" And he says, "Because right now there's a guy out there named Stu with 730-plus birds, and if I don't get out there, people could say that he's the greatest birder of all time, and he's not. This is what I'm great at. This is what I'll be remembered for. No one remembers who came in second." Sad, isn't it? I got to be the one who's the best. That's his idol. And his wife knew it. The point of the story, of course, is that Kenny ends up getting the record, 755 species of birds, but loses his wife. And Brad tells Stu, "He got more birds, but we got more of everything else." Something's important to him that everything else has to come in second to it. It's my own reputation, my own being the best, my own being noticed. Whatever it is, it can't come before our God in our lives. Only the worship of God can save us from idols. Means we're going to have to make it day by day the choice of knowing and honoring and serving and obeying God as the thing that our lives are about in every single aspect. It means saying, as God commanded in the Ten Commandments, according to Exodus 20, verse 3, "I will have no other gods before you, Lord." It means we don't see God as an advisor. We don't see him as a consultant. We don't see him as someone who makes suggestions, has some good ideas. He is the Lord of our lives. Do you have any idols before God? Here's a way that you can find out. Ask yourself, what is your worst nightmare? And that will tell you what your idol is. What is it you are so afraid of? Rejection? Humiliation? Then what you're really worshiping is your own approval. Is it terrible stress? You worship control. Is it being helpless? You worship power. Is it being uncertain and confused? Is it being financially ruined? Well, then you probably worship comfort and money in some way. Many of the people of ancient Israel suffered eviction from the kingdom of God because they refused to bow to the king. Let's make sure that we don't repeat their mistake, and let's make sure that God rules in our lives. Because if we do, then our religion will deliver what it actually promises. It will be the real thing. Let's pray. Father, we are challenged by this little story because we can see that we often become the tenants, the landlord who owns our lives, makes his claim on us, and we say, "Nah, I don't think I want to do that. It belongs to me. I want to do it my way." We all know we do it, Lord. We fall in love with idols of comfort or power or success or whatever it may be. We put them before you, Lord, and the results are always disastrous. So help us, Lord, to worship you as God of our lives and to let you have your way in everything we are and everything we do.